me, with my body while still under his weight. While I did that, I chanted that word no, until it became like the call of a struggling animal trying to free itself from a trap, haplessly trying to wriggle free from a predator. I started to panic. He was too heavy, having at least 50 pounds on me. I couldn't breathe. No became a meaningless word while I was under him. It evolved into a plea or a prayer instead of an instruction, as intended. And then, in all the futility, it was nothing but a cry, a feral squeal with no one to witness it. In the dark, there was no one to call out to, no one to help me, but I cried out the word nonetheless, just as I had been taught to do. I'm alone in the waiting room today, as I am for most of these monthly sessions. I leave my full-time job early to get to them, telling my manager only that I have an appointment, something that thankfully no one questions. The appointments are always the same day and time, Mondays at 5 p.m., because they are hard to rebook, both due to high demand and the challenge of anonymity. In the interest of client safety, calls from the clinic always come from a mysterious blocked number, which always triggers a deep anxiety in me. Most things, to be honest, trigger a deep anxiety in me. A counselor always struggles through coded conversations on the phone, so as not to betray the secrets so many victims keep from their loved ones and coworkers. I can't really say right now I'm at work, I will tell her. It's hard to live fully and authentically when you're keeping secrets like this. It's hard to feel alive when there's so many things you can't say. So few people even know that I come here, just a handful whom I deem safe to tell. My husband, my closest friends, that one sympathetic guy at the office who in exchange of confidences relays to me his own mental health struggles and covers for me when I need a break. I have a strict inner circle that I feel comfortable sharing my recovery with, as if I am doing something dirty and wrong that I should be ashamed of. I know that if I was sick, in the traditional sense, that would not be the case. People would rally around me and bake me casseroles. They would send cards and flowers and hope for my speedy recovery. They would take to social media and wish me well. Instead, when I walk into the hospital that houses the clinic, I am equipped with acceptable reasons for being there, that most survivors have practiced. Excuses at the ready on the off chance that I will run into someone I know. I have a routine medical test. I'm picking up a prescription. I'm visiting a friend's relative. It's nothing serious, nothing to worry about, I will say, hoping that it's true. From my seat in the waiting room, I nervously fumble with my phone, check baseball scores and television recaps, return messages, and try to ignore the muffled voice of an assessment nurse on the phone in the office behind me. She is likely the same nurse who asked me to tell her my story the very first time I came here. The referral came from a stranger, a doctor who was filling in for my regular provider when she was on vacation. At the urging of close friends who were concerned about my behavior, I made a same-day appointment, and when I was ushered into the replacement doctor's office, I told her I thought I might be depressed, that I was drinking a lot, that I had trouble sleeping and eating. I was sitting in the shower. I was crying, and the idea flashed in my head. I thought how I could make it end, I said. It was a moment that had been a long time coming. I spent most of my life to that point only barely coping, grappling with various incarnations of clinical anxiety, hypochondria, agoraphobia, claustrophobia, and panic attacks. I had an irrational, desperate, terrifying fear of disaster and dying, an ongoing flight impulse, and a penchant for panic, at the most inopportune times. I found being alone in the world difficult, yet I also found being surrounded by people difficult. But this severe depression was a new development, one that had whittled away at my constant debilitating fear of death and suddenly made it an ugly option for escape. At the point of my same-day appointment, I hadn't slept properly in weeks, and my mind was caving in on itself via a particular brand of sleep-deprived psychosis. A well-intentioned friend had slipped me a generous supply of heavy-duty prescription sleeping pills she had taken from her boyfriend, handing them to me in a Ziploc bag in the hope of relieving my pervasive exhaustion. Sometimes I counted out the pills on the coffee table and wondered how many it would take. Sometimes I eyed the contents of the cutlery drawer, studying the knives and pondering their effectiveness. Friends would come and visit and bring me food and styrofoam takeout containers, watching me slowly eat with barely concealed worry. I was in such a constant state of desperation, exacerbated by sleeplessness, that I cried hysterically in front of a complete stranger, this medical professional, while begging for help. The doctor, whose name I don't even remember, calmly took me through a depression assessment questionnaire and generously prescribed me Ativan. She encouraged me to consider antidepressants. She wanted me to get in touch with my family practitioner immediately for a battery of tests. When I finally managed to sputter out, "Something bad happened to me," she just knew. Without saying a word, she slipped a small square of yellow paper across the desk towards me. It was printed with information about the rape counseling clinic. I was struck by the ease with which she provided me with the contact, as if she'd done it hundreds of times before. The first time I went to the crisis center, I sat with the intake nurse, and together we Googled the man who had assaulted me, if only so I could have the satisfaction of a single other person knowing his name, knowing what he looked like, and where he is now. She slowly keyed his name in the image search as I spelled it out for her, and there among the photos was his smiling, unassuming face. A man, not a monster. I slowly raised a finger to indicate to her which one of the many men he was in the collection of images on screen. I had done this search by myself so many times, an obsessive action with the intent of self-protection, a rather futile way to ensure he was always far enough away from me so that I could feel safe. I remember with that photograph of him on her computer screen, she told me that she actually knew the names and faces of so many rapists, businessmen and journalists, professional athletes and real estate agents, husbands and fathers. That nurse who books STD tests, helps clients through reporting to the police, and sets them up with mental health care, is also the keeper of so many women's fiercely guarded secrets. She's an initial repository for their frantic fear and shame, and is so often the only other person who will ever know what happened to them. She stayed with me in her tiny office until 10 p.m., long past when she was due to go home, to make sure that I was no threat to myself. I remember apologizing to her when I realized how late I had kept her there, and she laughed kindly. "There's no better place for me to be than here with you," she actually said. I remember that I said no 16 times, and I remember that he accused me of being fucking dramatic. They always do that. They do that before when you refuse, and they do that during when you protest, and they do it after when you cry. I remember he told me not to be so emotional, told me to relax. Maybe he didn't actually say the word fucking, but my mind remembers it that way, as if the aggression of his profanity too makes my claim of violation more valid, as if swearing at me makes him a monster and not just a man. We always need them to be monsters. As if his profanity reinvents him for listeners as someone to be afraid of, just as he was reinvented for me in that moment, just as I was reinvented. There is this impossible paradox when you are victimized by sexual assault. You want to, you have to, convince yourself that it wasn't that bad, in order to have any hope of healing. If it really is as bad as you feel like it is, how will you ever get out from under it? How will you ever get better? On the other hand, you need to convince others it was bad enough to get the help and support you need to do that healing, to get out from under it, to get an appointment at the clinic, to get friends to come over with styrofoam food containers when you can't feed yourself. You tell yourself how bad it is, and then you numb yourself to how bad it is. You repeat as needed for so many years. Does saying no 16 times make me worthy of pity? Does it make me worthy of help? Unlike most health professionals, my rape counselor always arrives on time to collect me from the waiting room. She also always seems genuinely happy to see me. And today, like she always does, she politely asks if I'm ready or if I need a few more minutes. There is something about her predictable question that buoys me, feels empowering, as if she is affirming that it is my choice to be there to tell my story every time I arrive. I look up from my phone and smile at her, tell her yes, I'm ready as I slip it into my bag. And we leave the waiting room, engaging in small talk and pleasantries before we go into her office and do the necessary work. The smallest gestures make this therapeutic process different from what I've experienced before. A previous series of strictly scheduled $175 an hour cognitive behavioral therapy appointments, or a desperate 15-minute window with a doctor to refill a much-needed Ativan prescription. None of my previous therapy has actually stuck, and my hope is that this difference will bring some sort of finality. The promise of an end to the way I feel is the only reason for momentum. My rape counselor seems noticeably younger than me, her hair shaved to the skin on one side of her head, her clothes fashionable in a youthful way that I'm increasingly confused by as I grow older. I will discover later that we're actually very close in age, early 30s, but anxiety and depression both have a nasty habit of aging you, or at least the way you perceive yourself. She seems full of an optimism and energy, with a love of life that I have long since lost. It would be easy to resent her if she hadn't done so much work to help me. I've seen so many counselors, therapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists since I was sexually assaulted for the first time. A hapless guidance counselor at school who dragged me in for a talk after an English teacher flagged some dark poetry I was writing. A series of mental health professionals at the university clinic, all of whom seemed completely unequipped for me, primarily charged with doling out condoms and spotting eating disorders. And later, an ever-changing roster of costly psychologists with varying sensitivities to the issues around and reactions to sexual assault. A cognitive behavioral therapist once admitted that she felt helpless to treat my rape trauma, that it wasn't her area of expertise, and that I should seek help elsewhere. It was an admission that scared me, made me feel like I was too far gone to be fixed. Yet the day I met this particular counselor, she immediately seemed to be the most noticeably prepared and understanding of all the therapists I'd had, constantly reaffirming herself as open to any strange thought, impulse, feeling, or action of mine. In some ways, my rape counseling has felt entirely divorced from the traditional therapeutic model. It's permissive in comparison, focused on harm reduction and careful reassurances. It seems that, if something makes you feel better, it is a healthy option. Want to sleep all day? That's okay. Drink too much? That can be a valid coping choice. Isolating yourself via fear of the outside world? Self-preservation is important. To me, all of this is revolutionary, and it means that I can finally be honest with someone about my behavior without the fear of their disappointment. I usually walk into rape counseling assuming I am totally failing and floundering, that the people in my life deem me helpless, and she confidentially assures me I'm making real solid progress where I see absolutely none. My sessions with her are a short period of time where the expectations to be better are radically shifted from those of the world outside. In her office, I discover that the tiniest of steps I am taking to be emotionally free of my attacker are actually monumental for someone who suffers this hypervigilance and fear that can follow in the years after sexual assault. I feel lucky to have her, but alongside this is the knowledge that I wasn't assaulted in a particularly violent way. I sometimes feel like maybe some more worthy victim space is being taken up by my 20-year-old troubles, that I should be able to manage this by myself rather than gobbling up much-needed and sparse resources because of my inability to move on. When I raised this in counseling, she told me, "The survivor who was raped at knife point feels guilty she has taken up the space of a survivor who was raped at gunpoint. Everyone believes there is suffering worse than her own, and that they should be strong enough to cope without me." When you start any form of therapy, you're usually informed that everything you say is confidential, barring a threat to harm yourself or someone else. But I was told in my first session at the clinic that, although that still held true, my counselor understood the validity of the fantasy to harm your attacker as part of healing, and that the thought does not equal intent. "Sometimes I think about him getting hit by a bus," I admitted to her in one of those first sessions. She wasn't in any way rattled. "Why a bus?" she asked, genuinely interested. "Because then it's nobody's fault. It's an accident. Quick and clean," I said. "Do you want him to suffer?" "No, I don't want that kind of revenge. I just want him gone. I just never want to be afraid of running into him again." My counselor has told me of countless women talking in detail about castrating their rapists. They've explained visions of him dying in a fire, of him being beaten to death with a baseball bat, of him being attacked by wild animals. My lack of need for gratuitous suffering doesn't make me better or worse than any other survivor. In this space, I never feel like I'm disappointing anyone with what I'm thinking or how I'm reacting or coping. In the context of rape therapy, our terrifying feelings are normalized as part of the process, as is the insidious fantasy of self-harm. With rape recovery, it's just as normal an impulse to want revenge as it is to want to disappear, to want to die. My counselor has a specialized understanding of the kinds of inappropriate things women say in these private, fluorescent-lit offices, the secret language in which they speak to her and to each other. She's heard all the gallows humor, the obscene jokes, and the offhand remarks women need to make life tolerable. the darkness that they employ when facing the unimaginable task of simply living after being violated. Did you know him? Did you invite him in? Did you go willingly? Did he hurt you? Did he have a weapon? Did he force you? Did you wear something that provoked him? Did you want to have sex with him? Did you cook him dinner beforehand? Did you put on makeup? Did you tell him you liked him? Did you tell him you loved him? Do you regret anything you did that night? How bad was it, really? I once asked my counselor why she does this job, how she could stomach it every day, confronting all this female suffering at the hands of men. I feel blessed to be able to see so many women being so strong and seeking help. She responded without hesitation. This answer seems both rehearsed and impossible to me, but I believed her nonetheless. She offers the perfect balance of concern and reassurance, creating a space that smells like lemon verbena, and that has ample art supplies I'll never use, and books I'll never read, so that we can have conversations no one else will ever have with me. I trust her, and that is a monumental thing when you've learned, been conditioned, to trust absolutely no one. This has become a safe space where I can finally say the thing I've needed to say for so many years. I think I may have rape-related post-traumatic stress disorder, I blurt out. I've used the internet to catalog my symptoms with the growing fear that something is wrong with me. I've long denied the possibility, and yet I come back to it again and again. I've weighed the stigma of being sick against the hope of finding reprieve. I've gone back and forth, again and again, for years, and I'm finally given the room to say it out loud. I think you might be right, she replies, as if she has been waiting all this time for me to say it. She hands me a sheet of paper. Printed on it is a simple questionnaire that will be the first step on the road to a PTSD diagnosis. It is a step I've been waiting decades to take. Sexual assault must simultaneously be terrible and be something you're able to accept, which is an impossibly hard thing to negotiate. Inevitability must also be a key factor, because God forbid if there was something you could have done to stop it. How many times did you say no? I've realized that maybe I no longer need anyone to think it was bad enough. I don't need to prove that I am worthy of pity or help. I don't need you to feel sorry for me. What I need is what most women need when they talk about the sexual violence they have endured. I need someone to listen. I need someone to believe me. Whenever I tell the story, I say 16, even though now I know once was enough.
Reaping what rape culture sows. Live from the killing fields of growing up female in America. By Elizabeth Fairfield Stokes. If not for the father who first told me that rape was wrong and a gentle, patient husband, I think I could have easily gone through the rest of my life without ever having sex again. I wanted to deny that my body is part of who I am because it had been used against me. In 1981, I was 10 years old. I was watching an episode of Little House on the Prairie with my family when my little sister asked, "What's rape, Daddy?" He answered, "It's when a man puts his penis in a woman's vagina when she doesn't want him to." In the same tone of voice he used when he explained other hard-to-understand facts about the world, like the threat of nuclear proliferation, my sister nodded and turned back to the television. That episode, it was actually two episodes, Sylvia Part 1 and Sylvia Part 2, ended up giving me nightmares for years, made me hate my breasts when I got them, and hate Little House. In it, a girl, Sylvia Webb, developed breasts ahead of other girls in her class, attracting attention from the boys in Walnut Grove. Her father blamed her, first for the unwanted attention, and then when she was raped by a man in a clown mask. My father's explanation of rape affected me the same way his explanation of the Cold War had. It was abstract and theoretical and terrifying. It didn't jibe with the chubby, happy-looking man and woman lying in bed with hearts all around them in Peter Mayle's 1977 children's book about sex, Where Did I Come From?, which explains that the man wants to get as close to the woman as he can because he's feeling very loving to her, and to get really close, the best thing he can do is lie on top of her and put his penis inside her, into her vagina. The act was clearly the same, but the idea that a man would do that when a woman didn't want him to was alarming, to say the least. But adults have no way of knowing what children do with the information they are given, a fact of which I am now aware because I have two daughters. If, however, my dad's explanation was straight lecture, that Little House episode was an object lesson. Rape was a man in a clown mask watching you from the bushes while you picked flowers, then grabbing you when you're distracted by a flock of birds, throwing you on the ground and apparently putting his penis in your vagina. And it was your fault, because you had breasts. Sylvia, if you never watched, didn't survive her experience. She died after a dream sequence in which she was wearing a yellow dress and marrying a boy who loved her. Notice that her wedding dress wasn't white. It's hard to overemphasize the impact that show had on my sense of my body and my sexuality in general. When I learned, 10 years later, that Michael Landon had died, my first thought was of the boy in my 8th grade gym class who jeered at my chest, pointing and laughing at how my breasts flopped around when I ran. Sylvia's father had made her bind her breasts flat so they wouldn't show, and I longed to do that somehow. Sure, in the logical way adolescent brains work, that now that I had breasts, a stranger in the bushes wasn't far behind. I refused to walk anywhere alone. The world in which we lived reinforced the sense that I had no say in the matter of how men treated my body. Boys could laugh at our breasts in gym class and not get in trouble for it. Every day in high school, our bras were snapped, our skirts flipped up, our butts lightly spanked as we walked to class. If our nipples showed through our shirts, some asshole would inevitably say, "Cutting any diamonds lately?" On the rare occasion that any one of us girls complained to a school official about the catcalling and unwanted touching, it was met with, "It just means they like you. And of course, boys will be boys." The clown mask rape was the real worst-case scenario, though. That was real rape. Anything less than that seemed like it was supposed to be tolerable. Anything less than that, well, at least you could say it wasn't as bad as what happened to Sylvia. Date rape was a risk you took because you were a girl and you'd agreed to go on a date. The line between just being a girl on a date and being a tease never even existed. The prevailing message from the unchecked harassment we experienced at school was that if you did anything even remotely sexual, a kiss or holding a hand, you were leading that boy on, and you were responsible for anything and everything that happened. When I was 15, 2 years before I was really raped, I found myself alone in a car with a football player I'd had a crush on for a while. He kissed me. I was thrilled. He started unbuttoning my shirt. I wasn't thrilled. He was strong, and he held me down, but he didn't have time to force himself inside me because he was a teenage boy and had no sexual stamina. He sprayed my jeans, his arm across my throat, smashing my head against the car window as he humped my leg. I twisted away from him as far as I could get, my feet braced against the steering wheel, but he pinned my arm so I couldn't open the door. "We'd be hot at the prom," he said as he stuffed himself back into his underwear. You can cry quietly, or you can howl. You can scream softly, or you can pierce the air like a missile. But silence is just silence. It doesn't sound any different no matter how deep it is. It doesn't look like anything you or anyone else can see, especially when you don't look in mirrors anymore. If I didn't look at myself, I could pretend that nothing had changed. But silence smells. His sour, astringent acne cream biting the cold air, hot, salty semen and rank sweat like burning rubber. Silence feels, too, like you've swallowed rocks, especially when your throat is bruised from where his elbow crushed it, even though it didn't leave a mark. And it feels like his sticky mouth all over your face, his tongue like thick meat, slimy and choking, his spit dried rough on your cheeks. That wasn't rape, though, as I understood it then. He hadn't put his penis in my vagina when I didn't want him to. I don't think I had ever even heard the term sexual assault, but I know now that's what it was. At the time, it was just me making a bad choice by getting into his car in the first place. As Sylvia Webb's father told her after she was raped by the clown, "You reap what you sow." Same letters, different order. Reap, rape. When I was raped, 2 years later, actually penis in my vagina raped, it wasn't a stranger in a clown mask. It wasn't a stranger at all. It was someone who took what he wanted because the world taught him that when it came to women's bodies, he could do just that. Senior year of high school. I had been drinking, and I was semi-conscious on a bed at a friend's house, my leg in a knee brace after a skiing accident. A guy I knew came into the room. I opened my eyes slowly. He was putting a condom on with one hand and reaching for my underwear with the other. I tried to push him off, saying, "No, no, please, no." But there was nothing I could do. I couldn't walk without crutches. I had been drinking. I wasn't strong enough. I couldn't get away. Hot pain flashed through my whole body. I felt a burning surge in my face, my fingers, my toes. After he was done, I turned on my side, crying, drawing the leg that would bend up into my chest, seeing with half-closed eyes the bloody condom coming off, milky liquid dripping onto the floor. He looked at me and grinned. "What are you crying for? You said please. You were fucking begging for it." I told no one. It wasn't a stranger in a clown mask, but I knew that time that it was rape, and that it was my fault. For drinking, for hurting my leg, for being a girl. Reap. Rape. I'm far from the only child of the 80s whose understanding of sexual violence was impacted by that particular Little House episode. It's inspired fan pages and strange obsessions, things like Sylvia's dying dream sequence set to Hallelujah, for example. I couldn't bring myself to watch it, or any of the scenes from the original episodes. My avoidance probably just makes the anxiety I feel about clowns, Little House, and Michael Landon, he wrote and directed both Sylvia episodes, worse. But I'll take the walls I've constructed over the panic that those scenes might induce. I see no benefit in desensitizing myself to that particular trauma. Despite the lingering damage it did to some of us, the show is a minor skirmish on the killing fields of growing up female in America. Looking back, I can almost rationalize those episodes as an attempt at social commentary on rape culture. Perhaps Landon was trying to portray Sylvia's plight as a microcosm for the very real situations girls and women face, and was trying to call attention to it, rather than just calling it entertainment. But really, I don't buy it. His portrayal of the way a girl's body and the community betray her as she goes through puberty never felt like a full-throated critique, even before Mrs. Olsen's character reinforced everything I would later internalize about the unwanted attention girls got from boys at school. She insisted that Sylvia was leading the boys on, that she should be blamed for attracting their attention, and that, by extension, she should be blamed for the rape. Mrs. Olsen was the stereotypical small-minded gossip. Even though the episode contains a scene with the school council siding against Mrs. Olsen on the matter of whether or not Sylvia was encouraging the boys' attention, that message was not nearly as strong or as clear as it needed to be. I didn't even recall that the council sided with Sylvia until I recently read a synopsis of the episode. When I was 10, I couldn't get past the fact that there was even a school council meeting held to discuss whose fault it was that boys were sneaking up on a girl's house to peek in at her getting undressed. All these years, I only remembered that Sylvia had to get up and defend herself. If this was social commentary, an attempt to decry the hostility women regularly face on all fronts, it failed miserably. I knew women like Mrs. Olsen when I was in high school. They were the conservative Christian mothers of people I was friends with, and the mothers of a lot of the boys who snapped bras and flipped up skirts. These women loudly proclaimed their views about how boys and girls were supposed to behave. One of them found my friend Jamie making out with her son. She blamed Jamie, saying, "I won't tell your mother about this if you promise it won't happen again. Boys will be boys, and there are other girls they can go to for that." The twisted view of the two things women are supposedly for, either marriage or sex, but not both, still makes me shudder. I saw the sexism and the hypocrisy in it, but the Mrs. Olsons of the world wielded too much power then. I couldn't outshout them. It was hard enough being sexually assaulted at 15 and raped at 17. Compounding it was the mindfuck perpetrated by people like these mothers who promoted the biblical view of women as tempters, of boys and men helpless against their lusty instincts at the sight of a woman, dividing women into Eves and Marys, whores and virgins. I felt betrayed by my gender. Not only were men not to be trusted, but neither were women, apparently. There were, at least fictionally, the Ellen Jamesians, the women in John Irving's The World According to Garp, who cut out their tongues in solidarity with a woman whose tongue was cut out so she couldn't identify her attackers after she was gang-raped. They were separatists. They wanted nothing to do with men. When Garp's mother died, they wouldn't even let him attend the memorial service held at the center she founded for troubled and abused women. These women, I thought, had each other's backs. I encountered real separatists when I went to college at Smith, but the jokes about two dead men at the bottom of the ocean being a start didn't seem funny to me. There was, after all, still the saying, Smith to bed, Holyoke to wed, more of the whore or virgin dichotomy. My first weekend as a college first year, we were not freshmen, in a study carol at the library. I saw that someone had drawn a picture of an erect penis, complete with balls and pubic hair, and written, what could be more fun than a long, hard one? Someone else had scrawled underneath, cutting it off. I could identify with neither sentiment. There was no pleasure in sex for me, nor did I hate men. I didn't quite yet understand my collegiate landscape. It seemed to be an improvement over the misogyny I had left behind, but this men-for-sex-or-not-at-all worldview was not particularly uplifting either. While I appreciated calling out half the population for creating a situation in which many women rarely feel safe, and I understood how tempting it was to pin it all on men, I didn't have the energy to be angry all the time. I also wasn't gay, despite how easy it seemed to be gay at Smith, especially after what I'd been through, after what a lot of women go through. Trying to be gay, though, seemed like a way, perhaps, to be protected from violence, from abuse, from my own distorted view of my body and my sexuality. And I thought women wouldn't hurt me. But it wasn't true, and there was neither comfort nor safety in pretending to be something I was not. Women are just people, for better, for worse, as the Mrs. Olsons had shown. Evil is evil wherever you go, and I encountered a lot of it at Smith, too. Men weren't the problem. For a while, when I was in my 20s, I faked orgasms with men, just wanting the sex, on the rare occasions I had it, to be over. I wanted to be loved but not touched. I wanted to want sex, and I settled for the small comfort being close to someone brought me. But the assault, the rape, and the silences around them had created an almost total disconnect between my mind and my body. It wasn't until the guy I eventually married made it clear that he knew I was faking and wanted me to stop, that I started to care if I was enjoying sex or not. I knew only that my body was useful for other people's desires, not my own. There had been moments here and there when I sensed something like physical attraction or sexual arousal, glimpses or sips of something delicious but elusive. It wasn't enough, though, for me to believe that anything good could come of trusting those feelings or even exploring them, of willingly surrendering my body to someone else. There was pleasure in being wanted. That I could control. There was no pleasure in wanting. I was too afraid. A clown had gotten into my head, and a man had put his penis in my vagina when I didn't want him to, and the world, I had learned, was a place that didn't condemn sexual violence, it accepted and excused it. I had wanted to believe that each day without sex would get me farther and farther away from the man in the clown mask, the football player in the car, the bloody condom. I wanted those things to fade into such distant memory as to dissolve permanently. But I have had to take it all with me, because it is a part of my story. I grieved for many years the woman I would have been if I had not seen that episode of Little House on the Prairie, if I had not had a crush on that football player, if I had never been raped. She never got the chance to live. This is rape's legacy, the countless deaths women die just trying to keep existing in the world as it is. I have daughters now. I cannot protect them. I cannot get inside their heads and make them unafraid or know what they are thinking. I know that their minds are as inaccessible to me as mine was to my father. But I can try to equip them. I can help them believe that there is something in them that is unquenchable, something that is impossible to kill. I will myself to believe that they can believe all of that about themselves, even on the days that I struggle with the memories of what happened to me. They've never asked me or their father what rape is. We've already told them. We've talked about why it's wrong that the entertainment industry is obsessed with violence, particularly violence against women. We've talked about what it means that women are largely portrayed in pop culture as either victims, sluts, virgins, or gossips, and why that's not okay. We tell them that they can choose to live their lives in a way that is not defined by anything that happens to them, something that I have not yet been able to do. They listen. They nod. They dismiss what insults their souls. They are stronger than I am. This is what they reap. This is what I sow.
Invisible Light Waves by Meredith Toulousan. Between transitions, while I lived with five other recent nomads in Harlem, I met Paul in our kitchen one night. He'd worked with one of my housemates during a humanitarian service trip in China and was visiting her. He was fluent in Mandarin and majored in linguistics at Yale before enlisting in the Navy, where he did intelligence work in Washington, D.C. Maybe it was those experiences that gave him that efficient air I associated both with linguists and men in the military. I wanted him from the moment I met him, the way I wanted men I wasn't used to having, one of the strong, handsome white men on television I coveted when I was growing up in the Philippines. But I also knew there was something wrong about me wanting him, so my eyes cast themselves down when he said hello, and I tried to keep out of his orbit while he stayed at our apartment for a week. Then he came along when we went out dancing at an underground party in Brooklyn on his last night in town. I wore tight jeans and a black lycra tank top to show off my arms I'd toned for many hours at the gym, the shirt's low scoop making my breasts look bigger than they were. I'm usually too self-conscious about turning red from Asian glow to have any alcohol, but shortly after I drank the one vodka cranberry he offered me, I felt more free to hug him and smell his sweat. By the end of the night, we hadn't talked much, but he'd lifted me up onto a counter so I could rest my legs, which I wrapped around his hips from behind while he stood, while my lips couldn't help but touch his neck. Though I sobered up as we rode an hour in a taxi with my roommates to get back to our apartment, where I managed to leave him in the hallway and close the door to my room, alone. He was waiting for me when I opened that door again, late enough the next morning that the summer sun was too bright behind me and his presence came as a surprise. So did his kiss and the probe of his warm tongue. "I'm leaving in an hour," he said. He probably suspected that he just needed to have his lips on my mouth and I would crumple with want. I confirmed that suspicion, but my desire came with the need to get him over with so that my life could keep moving. It was easier to accept our attraction rather than listen to the part of me that knew it would be a mistake, to give in to the fun instead of saying the no I wanted to say. I was almost 30, but hadn't been in a situation before where I felt so conflicted about someone I was so physically attracted to. Maybe it was just prejudice, I told myself, how him being in the military colored my feeling that he wanted me but didn't respect me, how it wasn't right for us to be together. I compromised, told myself I only needed to make him come, that he would go away once he was satisfied, and that I didn't need anything else. I refused to let him undress me after he let himself into my room. He lay down on the futon mattress on my parquet floor, and I focused on my mouth's task, the act that once gave me pleasure, and did then too, despite whatever else I felt. I marveled at the thick, almost egg-white quality of his ejaculate, that tasted oddly pleasant, before my mind returned to things other than sex, how I'd promised myself not to get involved with men for a while, least of all him, because I'd grown to rely on them to feel as though I wouldn't break apart. Yet he knew how to soften my barriers, and so there we were, me not having said no, part of me wanting it, and so we did it. He left town, and I became preoccupied, maybe even obsessed, as I had predicted I might, ignoring the signs and seeing only how good he was on paper. The Yale graduate who spoke several languages and looked amazing in uniform, the kind of man I'd been taught I could never have. As we began to correspond, he told me over email that he'd just broken up with a Chinese girlfriend before coming back to America, and that he liked Asian girls in general. I flirted in my messages, almost like I was pre-programmed. I indulged in the game of prospective girlfriend, even though the part of my brain still engaged in self-preservation knew that he only wanted to fuck me because he hadn't gotten to. Maybe I wanted to believe that if I let him fuck me, then it wouldn't be true that he didn't respect me. I was too weak to say no anyway, and no objective court would consider me raped just because I'd wanted to say no, nor would I want one to hold him to account, even if there were moments when I asked myself if it was okay to feel raped, even if I wasn't. Instead of giving in to that thought, I volunteered to visit Paul in D.C., and we planned out dates and touristy things to do, like going to the White House and the Lincoln Monument. But after I arrived, he made a move to fuck me every time we were about to go out. Sunday morning, I was in his bedroom facing his bed, looking out the floor-to-ceiling windows onto his balcony, knowing I had to be at work the next morning, but determined to visit a museum with Paul, to be part of a couple and not a dirty fling. We hadn't left his apartment in days, and his white sheets were a moist amalgam of our sweat and fluids. I willed my mind to be pleased with itself, to enjoy feeling naughty as I put on earrings to finish my outfit. A black silk blouse, a long, deep violet skirt with hundreds of tiny pleats by a well-known designer, which I sold to a consignment shop after the trip, even though it was my favorite. We had agreed not to shower so we could smell the sex in our skin, and he told me not to put on underwear. I was too absorbed in finding the hole in my ear to notice that he had re-entered the bedroom, and I didn't feel him raise my skirt. He was inside me before I could even think to protest, and I didn't protest because I wanted it, or willed myself to want it. Or my body wanted it because for so long I didn't think that I deserved to be with men like him, even when the most important part of me wanted him to stop, precisely because I wanted to feel like I deserved to be with any man before I let someone inside me again. But how could I say no to desire? How could I say no to being fun, like those normal Asian girls he liked? For years I've told that story and said, it would have been rape if it weren't so hot, and then wondered to myself whether it could be rape, even if it was so hot. I left a fool's poem on his pillow before I got on the train, and he thanked me over email only after I asked him if he got it. I didn't hear from him again until one night, 7 years later, when one of my housemates from that period, the one who kept in touch with everyone, had a housewarming party, and I identified his charming sycophant's voice before I remembered his face. I felt the too close way he hugged me, like he had fucked me more than once, and only then did I know for sure that it was something I hadn't wanted, would never have wanted if it had only been up to me, in the way that my body tried to forget our contact even as our torsos touched. I'm here with my boyfriend, I said after hello. It's great that you're happy, he replied, like he knew or could presume to know. I stayed to prove that he could not affect me, mingled and revolved amid the successful crowd in orbits that sometimes led to him. As I felt his presence in those rooms, like invisible light waves, I came to understand that I may never rid myself of the feeling that I am grateful to him for fucking me, for making me feel like I could be fucked so much, that I could extract desire from a man so handsome and strong and smart. I came to understand that I have to live with being the type of woman who might, or probably always will, be grateful to the man she did not want to fuck, but who probably did not rape her. I also have to live with being the type of woman who might, or probably always will, feel guilty that she never told this man she's trans.
Getting Home by Nicole Boyce. 2 days after, I taped a towel over the window in my front door. I had never really thought about it before, that window. It was small and decorative. Who put it there? Maybe it was supposed to be charming, a decorative quirk of our post-undergrad rental home. Maybe it was functional somehow, a way to watch squirrels or make eye contact with my letter carrier. I had never thought much about this window before, but 2 days earlier, a man had masturbated at me at a nearby train station. Now, that window just seemed like what it was, a hole in the wall. I ripped masking tape into long strips with my teeth. I had already closed all the blinds, locked all the doors. My roommates weren't around, so I'd spent the last two nights at my boyfriend's house, delaying this homecoming. The encounter at the train station, I'd convinced myself of this over the previous 48 hours, had been targeted. It had not been a man masturbating near a train platform, but a man masturbating at me, 2 minutes away from my house, wedged into the familiar banalities that made up my daily routine. The smell of the nearby barbecue joint, the automated transit announcements, the bushes I stood near each morning on my way to work. He had masturbated at me near the city's third best cornbread. He had masturbated at me at a train platform where I'd once been kissed in high school. He had masturbated at me. He had masturbated at me. So I taped a towel over the window. It looked silly. It kept drooping, then falling down. I watched Everwood in my bedroom, going back to check on the towel every hour, feeling foolish. But I was very alone in the house that night, and the window seemed like the house's one remaining vulnerability. The perfect spot for a man to stand, eye to glass, and continue the looking he had started two nights earlier. When you don't walk alone at night, you are robbed of the world's quiet. The world is, you hear, very peaceful after 2 a.m. You've been told it's pink lit, a wash and a stillness usually only achieved by plugging one's ears. You imagine other people enjoying these pockets of quiet. You imagine them strolling the empty streets, feeling safe and solitary, having late night insights. They must encounter raccoons, stray cats, creatures made bold by sundown. You have little experience with these creatures. Encountering these creatures is not your priority. 2 minutes after, I was on the phone. It was my first 911 call, and it felt transgressive. Was this really an emergency? My classmates and I had been told as children that the police would fine you for unwarranted calls. Don't call 911 because your sister cut your bangs too short. But there was this masturbating man, the outline of his body in the bushes, the movement of his hand. So I was on the phone, my blood scraping through me like sheets of tin. Police? Fire? Ambulance? Dispatch seemed to operate too slowly. What is your emergency? I told the operator how he'd held his hoodie shut with one hand, the other hand on his penis. I told her how he ran when I pulled out my phone. Which way did he go? Toward the mall, I guess. He went in the direction of the mall. I told her his approximate height and weight, and how he yanked up his sweatpants before taking off. Then the call was over. The first call, and then a follow-up call with the police. This happens often, unfortunately. We'll send a car to the area. Then I was boarding my train, still thinking about the man's sturdy legs. Had they been hairy? Should I have told the police about that? Already, I doubted what I'd seen. If you'd asked me, a few weeks later, whether the man's knees were plump or knobby, I would not have been able to tell you. He was, already, a shape fading into the landscape, absorbed and dispersed through my neighborhood. It was the most vivid experience I've ever had, in which my brain couldn't supply all the details. Some details I did hold on to, if not the relevant ones. I was listening to Bonnie Prince Billy when I noticed him. The t-shirt I was wearing, low cut and black, showed what little cleavage my A-cups could muster. Afterward, I went to a music show and drank 2 steam whistle beers and stayed up until 3 a.m. I laughed with my coworkers and talked about work, and I didn't bring up the encounter because masturbators aren't small talk. When you don't walk alone at night, you save $20 monthly on drunken burger purchases. But you take cabs home from the bar, so you bypass that caloric gauntlet of delicious fast food outlets and spend the money anyway. People tell you about a late-night poutinerie that recently opened near your apartment, and how they spoon tiny pierogi onto the French fries. That poutinerie may as well be Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, for all the good it does you. You do not eat poutine alone at 3 a.m. Safety is your comfort food. 3 years after,
My university, in a different province, was on high alert. There had been 6 sexual assaults over the last 7 months, escalating in their frequency. A man had been following women, groping them, trying to drag them to the ground. The women had fought him off. Sketches of the suspect were posted around campus. In the picture, the suspect wore a hoodie. He had sculpted cheekbones and a square forehead. The campus, where I lived, worked, and studied for my graduate degree, was as tense as a stretched-out elastic band. People whispered outside classrooms. Instructors broached the subject gently. Stay safe. Already that semester, the university had been steeped in controversy after students at a freshman week welcome event had been reported chanting, "We like 'em young. Y is for your sister. O is for oh so tight. U is for underage. N is for no consent. G is for go to jail." As the assaults occurred, my residents put bowls of pink safety whistles in the common areas. I was sitting in there one day when a fellow student, who'd recently moved to Canada from the States, picked up one of the dinky plastic whistles. She scoffed, then said, to paraphrase, "This is ridiculous. Canadians have no idea what danger is. If you understood half the shit that happened in the States, you wouldn't be sounding the alarms over a bunch of attempted rapes." That student continued to walk to the library late at night. Meanwhile, I, along with many others, endured the lengthening waits for Safe Walk. Students in our residence organized a volunteer team of walking escorts, on call to meet people at the bus stop. Over nightly meals in the dining hall, people spoke of potential encounters with the attacker, with the self-doubting air of someone telling ghost stories. I think I saw him near the bus loop. He was just standing there, and then he ran. I think he was trying to cut me off. I speed-walked all the way home. And then, in a broadcast email, the university finally stated outright what we'd been covertly hearing all semester. Don't walk alone at night. I read that statement and I thought, this is the wrong message. This is a misdirected, victim-blaming message. I read that and I thought, what bullshit. But I also read that and thought, I don't. And in a quiet, complicated place within me, where logic gets bullied by fear, and fear masquerades as protection, thinking those words, "I don't," made me feel safe. When you don't walk alone at night, especially when you also don't own a car, you are a pain in the ass to your friends. They get sick of escorting you home. Some of them are real champs. They'll walk you to your door even when it's frigidly cold out. Others will sigh and say, "Can't you just walk, just this once?" The most frustrating friends are the ones who are gambles. When you dine with them, you spend the entire evening working up the nerve to ask whether they'll walk you home. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no. You never know which it will be, so you're distracted while they chatter over nachos. You hear only the ticking of an internal timer, counting the minutes until you must leave the restaurant. It reverberates in your chest. Maybe your friend will escort you home one time, but the next time you make late dinner plans, that timer will wind up again. You will feel its tension in your palms as you eat ceviche. The timer exists for that final moment, the moment you reach your door safely. At that moment, ping! You feel a calm so thick that it startles you. 2 weeks after, I wrote about the masturbator. I wrote about him because jokes are antidotes. They suck the power out of memories, right? So I posted a Facebook note. I wrote that masturbation, in my world, was only supposed to happen in American Pie, or behind the twin veils of locked doors and Catholic guilt. I joked about my clammy 911 call. I joked about the hoodie, the sweatpants, the sturdy legs. Then I waited for closure, for praise, for high fives and quick relief, for a certificate to arrive in my mailbox that said, "You are tough and self-aware." No certificate arrived. Instead, concern. Other women messaged me. They asked if I was okay. I told them yes, but meant no. Some were women I knew well. Others were women I barely knew at all. "It happened to me too," some of these women said. A man looking through a bedroom window. a stranger masturbating on the train in London. He was right there, on the seat across from me, that woman said. I was terrified. I just moved to a different seat and waited until the next stop. One story, two stories, three. Women in my life lit up like coordinates on a secret map. There was an unrequested camaraderie in it, a sense of uneasy companionship. We had all been touched without being touched. We shared something we'd never asked for. Part of the terror of my encounter, I realized, was this. It was unexceptional. In a way, I even felt lucky. I did not like feeling lucky. But there was sinister comfort in the sentiment. It could have been worse. When you don't walk alone at night, you wish that you did. You remember the times when you used to, before you made that decision, sudden or gradual, conscious or not, to stop. You used to walk the short distance home from the bus stop, never comfortably, but regularly, holding your keys as spikes between your fingers. You used to stride down the center of the street, your cell phone at the ready, then speed walk diagonally across your back lawn. You pine for these memories. They're a bleak thing to pine for, but you can't help but miss those moments, fearful as they were. They seem, compared to the current situation, like a kind of unappreciated freedom. 15 years before, / 2 years after, / ongoing. The news had advice for me. Put a pair of men's shoes outside your front door. Don't wear a ponytail, too easy to grab. Get a sign that says beware of dog, even if there's no dog. Carry pepper spray. Wear complicated pants. Instructions came from the Oprah Winfrey Show, Reader's Digest, Cosmo. Pee on your attacker. Submission is sometimes a strategy for survival. Kick out the taillights if you're locked in a trunk. Wave your hands to get other drivers' attention. My mother told me about a story she'd heard on the radio. A woman who'd covertly dialed 911 and narrated her surroundings as her kidnapper drove. Where are you taking me? Why are we driving past the McDonald's on First Street? I imagined myself as a forced tour guide, pointing out the local library. The stories kept coming, tragic or heroic or both, real or fictional. Survival is resourceful and marketable. On a winter weekend, I read Room and found myself thinking through theoretical escape plans, remembering how I used to carry cups of scalding water when I walked home from my old job at a coffee shop, ready to throw them at the slightest sound. Any and all media told these stories, stories upon stories upon stories. The stories were not my experience, but they were a cousin to my experience, a violent cousin. And I thought about them every time I was afraid, every time my breath caught in my throat. I slipped into their plots like rotten pieces of clothing. When you don't walk alone at night, you're a coward. You don't talk candidly with other women, who disembark from the bus at stops that look like sunless galaxies. With grace and confidence, they put one foot in front of the other, moving fluidly into the pitch-black night. They wave back at you as the bus drives off, until the only thing visible is the reflective strips on their backpacks. You envy these women. You wonder, how? You imagine that they must be unafraid or oblivious, but you know that isn't true. No one is oblivious. Some of those women have been assaulted. Some of them have told you their stories, and others have stories they haven't told. Still, they walk home, out of necessity or private conviction, or whatever else it is that makes people do what they do, despite reasons to be afraid. Knowing that, you feel like an imposter. Some of these women are survivors of something you've only glimpsed. At parties, braver women show off the special jabbing sticks they ordered off the internet. I'll fuck him up, they say. And even though you too once bought mace from a sleazy spy store and made a place for it in your purse and rehearsed pushing the trigger, you can't bear to walk home through dark neighborhoods. You are untrained in navigating sunless spaces. So, after outings with those braver women, you pretend to start walking home, then turn behind a Starbucks and call frantically for a cab. Climbing into it, you feel ashamed of yourself. It is 10 p.m. You did not earn your fear. 5 years after. Last May, I went to a barbecue at a friend's house, and I took the bus home.